Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the NBA Podcast, and a happy 2017 to you all. Hope you all had a great holiday season, and hope you've been enjoying the NBA in our absence. Before we get started here, be sure to check us out on Twitter at the NBA Pod. In our bio, you can find all three of our Twitter handles as well, so be sure to give us a follow. Also, check us out on iTunes. Please feel free to subscribe, to download, leave us some reviews. We'd love to hear feedback. And we are being hosted this year on FanRag Sports, so check them out on Twitter, at FanRag Sports. And for the NBA-centric account, is just at FanRag NBA. With all that said, today I'm joined by, as always, Morten Jensen and Sarah Chalea. How's it going, you two?
It's been good.
It's going well, Brian. How about you?
Doing well, Sarah. Did you emotionally recover yet from Tim Duncan's retirement ceremony?
Yeah, I'm getting there. It's nice to have had that moment to kind of, I don't want to say close the door. It still sounds horrible. but thank him at the very least. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
I didn't.
You didn't enjoy the retirement ceremony?
Yeah. It's rough.
Oh, I definitely enjoyed it, but I'm still emotionally drained from it because that was just beautiful. That was the perfect send-off in every measurable way.
Yeah, I was watching clips of it. You know, that was my birthday, spoiler alert, so I did not actually see the game or the retirement ceremony, but I spent the final few minutes of my birthday in bed on Twitter watching clips from the Spurs Twitter account, and it did seem like a very good way to send him off. I was glad curmudgeonly Pop even showed his soft side for a minute, which we will talk about a little later as well. We're going to dive right in now to our Since Last Time segment. You know, we've been gone for a couple weeks, so a lot of things have happened. The biggest one, Morten, we need to just go right to your Chicago Bulls. Surprisingly, the Rajon Rondo experiment took a negative turn. Fred Hoiberg benched him for the second half of a game, and he has yet to see the court ever since. He's been inactive for 3 or 4 games now. Michael Carter-Williams is starting in his place. After the benching, I mean, to Rondo's credit, he's been surprisingly positive, at least more so than he was when things went sour in Dallas. He did say he met with Gar Forman and John Paxton and didn't receive a clear-cut message about the benching, whereas the Bulls officials reportedly think they were very clear about his need to stay positive. So that's a fun subplot already. He did say he's open to a trade, and according to Joe Vardon of the Cleveland Plain Dealer, the Cavs are reportedly watching the Rondo situation as the Bulls, they beat the Cavs last night, Wednesday, and afterward, LeBron was complaining about them not having a veteran backup point guard because Kyrie's been hurt, so they've had to really rely on rookie Kay Felder a lot. So, you know, Rondo, who knows what happens there. Mort, I think we all know you are not surprised by what's happening here, but how do you see this whole situation being resolved? Do you think they are able to trade him by the deadline? Do you think they buy him out? Do you think they keep him until next year and hope he can resuscitate his value?
I think he's going to get bought out because as of right now, he has negative value. And let's just clarify, negative value means that you have to give up something of significance alongside Rondo to actually ship him off. So you could like attach a first round draft pick to Rondo and then someone would take him, because the first round draft pick would actually work as a sort of payment in order to take him. The Bulls are, I don't believe they're that stupid, even though they did sign Rondo in the first place. So I can't believe that they're going to do that. But I do believe that they're going to try to work out some sort of buyout. And LeBron, if he gets his wish and Rondo becomes a Cav, then LeBron is not the best general manager in the game because Kay Felder is better than Rajon Rondo at this point, I would argue. I would rather see the ball go through the hands of Kay Felder than I would Rajon Rondo because at this point, he's a complete flame out. He should be in China alongside Josh Smith.
So, Mort, talk to us here about what has gone wrong for Rondo in Chicago. why isn't this working out aside from the obvious spacing concerns that we all had coming into the year?
Well, that is the cause, the spacing concerns. He's actually been pretty great in terms of handling teammates and not being a dick to the media. he seems to be like, well, you know, you got to give him credit. That was a problem once before, and fair enough, he did, I believe, throw a towel at Jim Boylan, and that was pretty ridiculous. But outside of that, he's been decent, and I'll give him credit for that. But it's just when he's on the court, it's everything comes to a stop. He's a ball dominant guard who doesn't score, who squeezes out fake assists. He grabs a lot of rebounds. That's positive, but they don't really need that a whole lot because they got a lot of capable rebounders already. So that supposed asset of his being a great rebounder is kind of nullified. When he can't shoot an open jump shot, and when he can't space the floor via a three-point shot or even get to the line, I think Jason Pat from our side today's Fast Break, a fan rack, said he had been 1-for-5 from the free throw line in December. Like, that's when that means that you're not a weapon offensively as a jump shooter, as a slasher, or as a free throw shooter. Meaning you have zero offensive game. You can't do that in today's NBA. Look at how the point guard position has changed. Fair enough, in the 80s, it was all about, hey, I'm a point guard. It's my responsibility to get people going, yada, yada, yada. No more. Not today. In today's game, you need a point guard who can hang 20.
Yeah.
Rondo, he may be able to hang 20 in a month.
Wow.
That's the problem right there. And also, he's an abysmal defender. I mean, I know his reputation says otherwise, but just watch a game. So many blowbys. I mean, James Harden compared to Rajon Rondo looks like an all-defensive candidate. It's so horrid, Brian.
Yeah, so it's safe to say Bulls fans are out on the Rajon Rondo era. I think you're right, Mort, that at this point, he does have negative trade value, and they're just going to have to buy him out. Luckily, they didn't guarantee the full salary next year. I believe it's only $3 million guaranteed. Right. So, you know, especially with the cap going up so significantly, that's a negligible price to pay to get him off of the team. In the meantime, Michael Carter-Williams is now their starting point guard. He's been playing fine. You know, he's whatever.
Whatever. Yeah.
I don't think he's your long-term option, but he's passable. So we'll see. We'll keep an eye on Rondo in the coming weeks. First, to see if he even gets on the court, and then second, to see where he ends up either after the trade deadline or before. Maybe some team gets really desperate. Another big piece of news that came out from ESPN.com's Mark Stein and Brian Windhorst on the trade front is that the Atlanta Hawks are fielding trade offers for Paul Millsap. He is set to be a free agent at the end of the year, and after losing Al Horford for nothing last summer, they're apparently scared of the same outcome for Millsap. For whatever it's worth, Millsap told Chris Vivlamore of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, quote, "I think everybody knows where my heart is and where I want to be." And then when asked if that meant Atlanta, he said yes. So, Sarah, should the Hawks, who have won 4 straight, and they're now the number 5 seed in the East, be willing to trade Millsap between now and February 23rd?
You know what I will say, first of all? I don't appreciate the timing of when that rumor came out, because it came out the day that they played the Spurs, and I swear he read about it at halftime and then proceeded to torch the Spurs in the second half. At first I thought like he was auditioning because he wanted to be a free man. Apparently he wants to stay. So maybe he was trying to show them that he should stay. I don't know. It probably had nothing to do with it, but I'm still mad. I mean, I guess willing, but if he wants to stay, I'd rather see them hang on to him, honestly. I guess teams should always be open to seeing what they can get back. So I guess it just depends on the return. But so, you know, sure, open to depending on what they can get, but I personally would rather see him stay.
Yeah, I think how you phrased it makes perfect sense. And I don't even think Stein and Windhorst did not say they are, like, actively seeking to trade him. It's mm-hmm. just, like, they're taking calls on him, which, as you said, any good general manager, there should be very few untouchables in the league. Right. Like, you know, if someone calls for Kevin Durant, you are just going to hang up immediately. There are maybe 10 players in the league who fit that criteria. Maybe.
Yep.
You know, everyone else, especially given Millsap's contract situation, yeah, if, like, a team is willing, you know, if Vlade took over the Warriors and offered Curry and Durant for Paul Millsap, you damn well better say yes.
Right away.
You know, some weird alternate universe where that happens. But, yeah, I think how you phrased it makes perfect sense that they should be willing to. They should not actively seek to do so unless, of course, he has come, you know, he would not be the first person to say one thing publicly and tell the front office something else privately. So if he says, yeah, of course, my heart's in Atlanta, if you give me a 5-year max deal or else I'm leaving, then you got to explore the market a little bit. So, Morton, I'm going to toss this one to you because you are the crazy trade guy. Where do you think the most logical or likely destinations for Millsap are or should be if the Hawks do end up trading him?
Toronto, but let me just preface this by saying something beforehand. If Atlanta enters trade negotiations with Toronto, the price for Millsap is going to get higher than it would if Atlanta were going to, for example, trade him to Indiana. The reason being, if you're a stone throw away from reaching the finals, then you can squeeze as much as you can out of an asset.
Yeah.
So, for example, if you're Toronto, the price would probably be something along the line of Jakob Poeltl, Corey Joseph, a first-round draft pick this year, a protected first-round draft pick in 2019. I haven't looked at the draft picks. I don't know if they have all of them. Mm-hmm. I'm not really sure, but just theoretically speaking.
Sure.
And then maybe Terrence Ross for just to fill out the salary.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be the deal. And that's a hell of a lot to give up for Toronto. It's giving up debt. It's giving up the future. But it's doing so for Paul Millsap.
Mm-hmm.
I would do that because if you have a core of Valanciunas, Millsap, Carroll, DeRozan, and Lowry, hell yeah. I mean, that brings them closer to Cleveland than people would want to admit.
Yeah. Yeah. ESPN's Kevin Pelton had a thing about Toronto specifically and how Millsap would affect their chances against Cleveland. And he said basically reached the same conclusion that's at that point, it's a toss up of a series. You know, especially you never know what's going to happen with Cleveland. Like, you know, we can't bank on health. So, like, if one of their big three goes down, the East is now wide open. I mean, I think especially, you know, it's tough because in one sense, Millsap is a free agent in July. So you don't want to give up too much for him because you're afraid he's going to leave. In the other sense, for Toronto especially, they're going to be capped out for the foreseeable future. So you acquire Millsap for his bird rights, basically. You acquire him because you are not going to be able to get a player of his caliber in free agency. So you can at least, you know, retain him with his bird rights. Your salary is going to go into the stratosphere and you're going to be paying luxury tax for the next couple seasons. But, you know, this is your best chance to win a title or get to the finals for the foreseeable future, because Kyle Lowry's 31, you know, DeRozan, I think he's still in his prime, but like Kyle Lowry this is the end of his prime. Basically, he's only going to go down after the next year or two. So yeah, I do think Toronto is the most logical or likely spot. I think Portland makes sense as well, just because they've been having, you know, such struggles, especially lately, and they could use another front court player. They have a glut of backcourt guys. I know, Mort, you mentioned, you know, Alan Crabb as a person who could go back to Atlanta. Denver is also a fun one if they just want to consolidate some of that. You know, Denver's problem is they have like 11 or 12 rotation caliber players, and they just don't know which ones to use. So, like, they've got a couple guys who could be expendable but still have value. in the right situation. So we'll keep an eye on Millsap because that could make this trade deadline a lot more fun than I think last one was kind of a dud, if I remember correctly. So a superstar trade like Millsap would be pretty interesting. And let's be clear, Millsap is a superstar. I've been seeing stuff on Twitter about how, like, oh, why would you give up so much for Paul Millsap? Paul Millsap's like a top 15, top 20 player in the league. He's fantastic. Yeah. Just because he's in Atlanta and doesn't get the national love that, you know, the Bay Area guys do or the guys in Cleveland do, he is a fantastic, well-rounded player who would be a great fit on just about any team. You give up the bank for Paul Millsap. So we'll see what happens there. We're going to go right back to your Bulls. Along with this Rondo nonsense, ESPN.com's Mark Stein reported Fred Hoiberg may be on the hottest seat in the league. Hoiberg didn't sound all that concerned once the report broke. The report came out last Friday. Hoiberg last Friday said, someone just mentioned something to me about that. You know, I don't know anything about it, so I'm not going to comment on it. So, Mort, I'm going to let you rant here. Should the Bulls be consider moving on from Hoiberg, or should Garpax be the first to go?
You both watched The Simpsons, right? Or have watched?
Yes.
Yeah. Can we agree that the prime of The Simpsons was at least 12 years ago?
Yes.
And it ended 12 years ago? And it's just been running these last 12 years on reputation alone?
With apologies.
Built on...
Apologies to Sean Hyken, but yes.
Yeah. And just, it's solely built on the glory of the past, where they were the winners of every TV award.
Yeah, I think...
Yeah, I think I just said everything I wanted to say there, Brian.
Okay, so you are in team Fire Garpax and let Hoiberg be Hoiberg.
I am in Fire every damn one.
Ooh.
And start over. Here's I came up with an idea based on a tweet from Sam Hinkie. You're going to love this.
Oh, boy.
Mike Sarin. Mm. Mike Sarin is an upcoming general manager. He's an assistant GM in Boston right now. Mm-hmm. I want to give Sam Hinkie the job of team president and then hire Mike as the general manager for the Bulls. That would be great.
That would be fun.
Could you just imagine that pairing?
Oh,
give Sam Hinkie more power.
Yeah.
And then have a wunderkind in Sarin handling the day-to-day.
Yeah, and dealing with the agents and being the more public face, so Hinkie doesn't have to do all that stuff.
Yep.
Yeah, that's evil. That's
evil because it's a good idea.
Yeah, right. Like, just it would devastate me, but I would be happy for you, and I would be even more of a Bulls fan if they do that in the next 2 months. I will pressure my wife to stay in Chicago when she's choosing a residency even more than I already will. I definitely think Garpax should be the first to go. I think, you know, we said it in the summer. Like, Hoiberg he came in with this reputation of being, like, a fast-paced, space-it-out kind of guy. That's what the offense he ran in Iowa State. They give him a roster with a Rondo, Wade, Butler backcourt. That is, like, completely antithetical to his style. It was, frankly, we said it in the summer, it was a Thibodeau roster. So, you know, I don't know that Hoiberg is the answer. I don't know if he's a good coach because we haven't seen him with the personnel befitting his style. You can argue, well, he needs to adjust, and he has, I would say, to mixed results. But I think if you really want to evaluate him, give him a roster that makes sense, that like fits with his style, because we've seen it the last couple games with Rondo out and Wade. He missed a game and he was limited. Like, you know, Jimmy had that game where he went off for 52 points, where he was kind of the point guard. That
was beautiful, by the way.
Yeah.
That was absolutely beautiful. Jimmy with shooters is a great strategy. They just ran him like James Harden.
Right. Yeah. It's like that was, you could kind of see that if that style of offense was what Hoiberg's system is, why have they not been doing that the whole time? So I would personally give him one more year with a roster that makes more sense around him. before giving him the axe. But yeah, I think Garpax.
I'm going to leave that up to Sam Hinkie, though. Yeah. That's not my decision. I'm going to leave that up to Sam Hinkie.
Sam Hinkie's loyal, man. He knows the value of loyalty after this Sixers nonsense. So we'll keep an eye on Hoiberg and all the mess that's surrounding the Bulls right now. Another saga that is actually finally over, Donatas Mataiunas has signed with the team. It will not be rescinded, unlike the Brooklyn deal. Houston released his rights, you know, once they matched his Brooklyn offer sheet, and then he failed their physical again. So he signed a one-year minimum deal with the Pelicans on Tuesday, and he has passed his physical. So no concerns. He is a New Orleans Pelican. You can make jokes about the Pelicans' medical staff all you want, because they have quite a spotty record as of late, so Godspeed to his back. But Sarah, I want to ask you, what do you think Mataiunas brings to New Orleans specifically? And do you think if he can stay healthy, if he becomes a consistent rotation player, will he be enough to help them win the number 8 seed that no one seems to want?
That's kind of the question. Yeah, I mean, considering how incredible that battle is, what that situation is, it's so many teams under 500. Somebody's probably going to get that spot under 500. Hey, it's anybody's to win at this point. Like you said, nobody seems to be stepping up to take it at the moment. Right. But I mean, he's a skilled player. He strong body, strong base. He's got good footwork. He's got a nice little hook shot. He can step out and hit the three. Never been a huge rebounder, but certainly can help a little bit in that area. I mean, he definitely can help them. I think he could put them into that 8th spot. He's got a long way to go, probably conditioning-wise. You know, he's been out of the game for a while. But, you know, he definitely could help take some pressure off of AD, which, God bless, you know, we all want to see that happen for him. Mm-hmm. So hopefully that will happen. But, yeah, I mean, he's a skilled player. I'm glad to see him finally, hopefully, get back to the league here and to playing. But, I mean, can we talk about how much money he lost?
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I was waiting on that.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Yeah, his agent did not do him any favors, just as a
BJ Armstrong.
Yeah, I mean,
he's his agent.
Yeah. As a reminder, he could have had upwards of $35 million over 4 years. Instead, he signs for a one-year minimum deal. That said, if he plays well and stays healthy, you know, he could hit an even bigger jackpot this summer. So we'll have to go back, you know, 6 months from now to see how this saga actually ends and if he finds a long-term home. But yeah, so far, not BJ Armstrong's finest moment as an agent. One more thing before we get into our deep dive section. All-Star Game voting. The first update was just released pretty much minutes before we hopped on today. I want to talk about two surprises, I would say, and then one that I'm just very happy about. The first surprise, which if you followed last year, is actually basically the same story. Zaza Pachulia. It seems like the Russians are also hacking All-Star Game voting. Is not just the U.S. election, because Zaza Pachulia is second in the Western Conference front court votes. He is ahead of, I believe the only one he's behind is Kevin Durant. Yeah, he's ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
He's ahead of Kawhi Leonard by almost 100,000. And ahead
makes
of
me sick.
Yeah. Ahead of Anthony Davis by more than 100,000. So, reminder that this year the NBA changed the way the voting system works. Fans are only constituting 50% of the vote, and then the media gets 25%, and other players get 25%. So even if Zaza stays second in the West, he probably will not be a Western Conference front court starter. But
he might be the sole reason for that change. We can thank him in the country of Georgia and Vine stars and whoever else made this happen.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyone who's not happy with the change, it's their fault.
It's the Zaza rule.
Thanks, Zaza.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So otherwise, if the starters were solely based on fan voting right now in the West, it would be Steph, Harden, with Russ, he's only a couple thousand behind, KD, Kawhi, and Zaza. In the East, it would be Kyrie, Dwayne Wade, LeBron, Kevin Love, and Giannis, which is another thing. I just like to celebrate everyone who realizes how well Giannis is playing right now. Yeah. Morton, you mentioned him as your most improved player a couple weeks ago. And at first I thought, like, well, you know, last year he kind of showed these flashes after the All-Star break. He didn't really, like, jump to mind as an obvious MIP candidate. But now, having looked a little deeper into it, like, he's blowing the competition out of the water. I think it would be heinous if he did not win Most Improved Player and also start the All-Star game, even though it means... Oh, sorry, go ahead, Mort.
No, last time I checked, he had a PER of 28.8. Jeez. He's 22 years old.
Yeah, if you guys haven't seen it yet, Lee Jenkins had a really good profile of him from Sports Illustrated with an anecdote about how I think the first time Jason Kidd, like, benched him, or I think it was when he benched him, Giannis went and looked up his stats. He's like, well, I'm going to see, like, who the hell is this guy? What did he do? And they looked up his career stats. He's like, oh, I better shut up. So that's a fun Giannis story. But yeah, I mean, the kid's averaging like 22-8-6-2-2, which is unprecedented, especially for a 22.
Oh, better than that, Brian. 24-9-6-2-2.
There you go. Even better. My God. Yeah, so you got a keeper, Milwaukee, and even though it means my boy Joel Embiid is fourth in All-Star voting, so based on fan votes, he would not make it. I would like to say, you guys, he's trying to get a date with Rihanna. He's trying to date Rihanna. He keeps alluding to this, like, mysterious, I'm trying to get a date with my crush. TMZ had a story this week that said his crush is Rihanna, which dates back years since he's been in the league, basically. He apparently, like, tweeted at her right when he got into the league, and she said, come back when you're an all-star. So he's now trying to be an all-star for that reason. And then someone asked Sixers coach Brett Brown about this, relaying this quote from Derek Bodner of Philly Mag. And Brett Brown says, well, if it does, there's another reason for me to try to help promote him. I had a different agenda, but if that's a side benefit for Joel, I can see that. He's got good taste. So, hashtag NBA vote.
Awesome.
NBA vote, Joel Embiid. Let's get him. Kevin Love's totally deserving as well, and he would get in as a reserve either way. So let's get Joel Embiid as a starter in the All-Star game so he could date Rihanna.
Oh,
I can only support this whole movement if he uses the opportunity to then curve her back. that's the natural way that has to work. Once you then are the All-Star, you have to say, nope, right. Sorry, missed your chance.
Yeah. You gotta be in Battleship too before I talk to you.
Oh, that was so horrid. But yeah, like I would have to agree with Mr. Embiid. He's got, it's good taste.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I get it. I get the whole pursuit.
Yeah.
I mean, look,
he's
why not? Why not use your status a little bit?
He's been dogged. If you guys remember, like, when he came into the league, he was, like, photoshopping himself at dinner with her. Like,
yeah.
It's...
Oh, he's been a great follow, like, from day one.
Yeah, it's like...
He really has.
It's been close to stalker, but it's because it's JoJo, it's just funny. So, again, hashtag NBA vote Joel Embiid. Let's get JoJo in the All-Star game so he can finally get his long-awaited date. I want to take... We're going to go into our deep dive section now. We've basically covered every team outside of the major contenders. So we're going to move into the contenders today on the East. And then next time we're going to touch on the big ones in the West. Before we do the two big ones in the East, we need to talk about the Detroit Pistons, who we mentioned a few weeks ago, right before Reggie Jackson's return. And, our theory was at the time, hey, how is that going to hurt them? They're getting their starting point guard back. It's going to be very similar to the Pelicans getting a boost when Jrue Holiday came back. Turned out that that is not the case. Since Jackson came back on December 4th, the Pistons are 27th in offensive rating, ahead of only Miami, Philly, and New Orleans, and 19th in defensive rating. On the season, The Pistons are nearly 10 points per 100 possessions better defensively with Andre Drummond off the court. It's a 98.1 versus on, which is 107.8. Stan Van Gundy, their head coach and team president, just ripped into the team after they lost 121-116 to Indiana on Tuesday, saying, quote, "I thought our closeouts were bad. We just left people open. It's like we hope people are going to miss early on. We wait to see if we're going to have to make the effort to close out." Marcus Morris in mid-December also threw some shade at Jackson during a players-only meeting, which led to Jackson pouting and playing passively during the first half of the next game. I believe that was against Chicago, if I'm not mistaken, Mort, which Zach Lowe of ESPN called him out on. So, Morton, what in God's name is going on with the Pistons, and do they have any hope of turning their season around?
Oh, well, that last one is a tough question because I think he's still getting integrated into the offense, and that's where the most of the problems lie. It seems like ball movement kind of stopped when he returned. Mm-hmm. He's pounding the ball a lot. He's taking a lot of shots, and he's just taking up possessions a whole bunch. And it seems like without him, they had some sort of cohesiveness that they are lacking now. Mm-hmm. So, but outside of that, I mean, no, I do see it as solely him just being reintegrated in the system as the major problem. Whether they can turn around in time, that's the big unknown. Right now, I believe there are 5 games below .500 at this point.
Yes.
So it's not in like an impossible situation, but it's also one that needs a lot of work to get up and you know, get over 500 and significantly above 500. If they miss the playoffs, it might not be the end of the world because they could use a good draft pick. Mm-hmm. They could use another youngster to add to this roster. Like, there's a guy out there who I think would be beautiful in Detroit, and that's Malik Monk.
Oh, yeah.
From Kentucky.
Yeah.
Like, he would be great there. So if this ends up being the consequence that they get a high draft pick and miss the playoffs, I'm sort of good with that if I'm a Pistons fan.
I'm good with that so long as they don't take Malik Monk because he's going on the Sixers. They can stay away from Malik Monk. But yes, they are 16-21 right now. They're only 2.5 games behind the Pacers and the Bulls for the 7th and 8th spot in the East, so they are not out of it by any means. But it does seem like... I mean, Van Gundy is very frustrated with this team. You know, he's been shuffling their starting lineup with some regularity lately. He moved John Luehr into the starting lineup a few games ago. It just seems like he is searching for answers. And, you know, I don't want to say they necessarily need to move Reggie Jackson to the bench because, you handed the guy a $80 million contract a year and a half ago as your answer to the starting point guard question. Like, Ish Smith, maybe it's just Ish Smith is like the perfect journeyman point guard. Like he resuscitated the Sixers for 2 straight seasons. Like, they could not play basketball until Ish Smith came. And then Ish Smith, like, played really well in Reggie Jackson's absence. So maybe, you know, maybe it just comes down to Jackson emulating Smith's style of play a little more. I mean, Jackson has never been... He's always been that score-first point guard rather than the distribute-first, score-second. Never had that mindset. So maybe he's just got to move into that. But it does seem like there are some major problems plaguing this Pistons team on both ends of the court, frankly. And it seems like they're allowing their offensive struggles to then affect their focus defensively. I don't know what to make of that stat about Drummond, you know, them being 10 points per 100 possessions better with their supposed rim protector on the court. Because, again, like, you just handed Drummond a massive extension. So, you know, I think, Mort, you said it well, that their season is not over. They still have plenty of time to figure it out. But, you know, they're nearing the halfway point of the season. So time is ticking for the Pistons to get back in the race.
On Drummond, just one thing about Drummond. He's in his, let me see, his fifth year now. Mm-hmm. We were all waiting on him to become this defensive beast.
Yeah.
Are we about ready to say that he's going to be one of those guys who is continuously going to be a fantastic rebounder, and he's going to be like this 15-point guy. He's sort of like going to be a 15-15 guy, mm-hmm. but defensively speaking, he's probably going to top out as average.
Yeah, I'm surprised by, you know, I expected him to be more of a shot-blocking presence than he is.
Yeah.
And more of like a rim-protecting presence than he is. I haven't delved too deep into what in particular is plaguing him, or whether it's, you know, a product of his teammates leaving him in tough situations and he's got to recover, kind of like what happened with Nerlens Noel a lot last year. It's definitely a concern, I would say. I mean, he is still really young. Like, I think he's only, what, 24?
23.
So, yeah. You know, it takes big men. It's well known that big men often take a long time before they really hit their stride defensively. So it's like, I don't think the ship has sailed necessarily. That said, it's tough to see him becoming an elite defensive presence at this point. Like, maybe he tops out at above average in a couple of years. But, yeah, I mean, that is a huge concern right now. And maybe it speaks to how well, you know, their backup bigs have been playing. Like, maybe they've just... We said that before the season started, that they would, having Aaron Baines around is going to be a blessing for them. So maybe it's just like he's playing lights out. But I mean, 107.8, that's toward the bottom of the league defensively. So
yeah,
that's an issue.
He could stand to lose some weight as well.
Yeah.
Like Drummond. Yeah. I remember I sat next to him for 3 days
the summer. Right.
When he was in Denmark, and I mean, look, he's got an NBA body and whatever, but you could see that he would benefit greatly from slimming down. If he could lose 20 pounds and get more ripped, he would have that extra bounce in his step,
mm-hmm.
which I think could really help him defensively. At this right now, he's listed at 6'11", 280.
Wow.
I mean, that's a lot of weight to carry around. Yeah. And, you know, he's athletic at 6'11", 280, yeah, but... Right. Just imagine the athleticism at 6'11", 260.
Yeah. Geez, I didn't realize it was 280. Wow. Yeah, that's a good point. That is a good point. So, well, I mean, again, Pistons fans, I don't think it's time to check out on the season just yet. You still have plenty of time to turn it around, but time is definitely ticking.
It's disappointing, though.
Yeah.
Because I really liked what they had going on when Reggie was out. You guys talked about Ish, you know, he wasn't scoring especially well or efficiently, but he ran the team really well.
Mm-hmm.
And I did say back then, you know, that there might be some immediate regression when Reggie came back, but I in no way expected this.
Yeah.
And it's a little worrisome because I don't know. It's kind of going to come down to how flexible he is, and I don't know that he's that flexible. He has not shown a penchant for being flexible in his career, so we'll see what happens.
Right.
I'm surprised you haven't just flamethrowed Stan Van Gundy for not playing Boban more.
I don't know why. Why are you going to poach him and then park him on the bench? I don't know, but...
No, 76 minutes on the year. He's better than that. Yeah. Come on.
I don't get it. But whatever.
And the rookie, Henry Ellison, has played 37 total minutes. Maybe that's actually... a slight concern as well. Like, they have capable big men that they might, you know, need to get another look at. Like, Henry Ellison, I think he was drafted 18th, right? That's not low.
Yeah.
And he can shoot the ball at Marquette. At least he looked good shooting the ball. I know his percentages were a little down, but he had good rhythm. It's nice mechanics. I mean, he could be plugged in there and help out Drummond a little bit. I don't see why... the Van Gundys in general, because Jeff is the same way, or at least he was when he coached. Like, the youngsters, they really have to wait their turns.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like there's a lot going on behind the scenes in Detroit that we are not privy to, and that could be contributing to some of this downslide. So, Sarah, I think you said it well, that it's going to be up to Reggie to adjust his playing style, but yeah, as you said, he has not really shown much interest in doing that to this point in his career. So we'll see what happens in Detroit. Cleveland, you know, aside from their lack of backup point guard depth that LeBron complained about on Wednesday, they're otherwise rolling. They're 26-8. They're 3 games ahead of the Raptors and have the league's 4th best offense. Kevin Love, I mean, he has never looked better in Cleveland. He's playing out of his mind, as I, you know, we talked about during the All-Star segment. He's very well deserving of the All-Star berth that he is going to receive. And Kyrie Irving is also having a career year. Channing Frye has been a huge pickup for them. They did lose J.R. Smith for most of the regular season, which is a blow, but they've got some young guys who have been playing well in his stead. So, Sarah, do you think Cleveland is still miles ahead of everyone in the East? And do they have a legitimate shot of toppling the Warriors in the finals? They did beat them 109-108 on Christmas Day.
Yes and yes. I mean, it's important that they get JR back healthy, you know, and obviously stay healthy. But, yeah, I would give them a legitimate shot. And, yeah, unfortunately, even though, you know, I like what the Raptors are doing and, you know, we thought Boston was going to be a little higher than what they've done so far. Yeah, I think Cleveland is still well above everybody else. You know, I don't want to, you know, just go off the Christmas game and say that I would give them the edge right now over the Warriors, but the Warriors, that turnover problem, I can't trust right now. Mm-hmm. So you still feel like if I had to bet on one, you know, I keep thinking they're going to figure it out, but they keep throwing passes to the other team that make no sense. So, yeah, so far I would give a slight edge to Cleveland in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, I think if nothing else, it is closer now than it's ever been before. Whereas, you know, the Warriors entered as a considerable favorite last year, and especially after going up 3-1, the lead that they then proceeded to blow. At that point, you were like, oh yeah, this makes sense. They're up 3-1, of course. Like, they, you know, they're just a better team than Cleveland. But it does seem like, especially LeBron has figured out ways to pick them apart and, like, really frustrate them. Maybe he's just, like, the cerebral aspect of that matchup he's exploiting more than the Golden State guys are at this point. You know, I mean, KD,
I think it makes a big difference not being afraid of them. And they're very clearly not afraid of the Warriors.
Right.
It matters.
Yeah, because so many teams are just, like, they go in and get, you know, they expect to get their doors blown off, and then they get their doors blown off, and there's, like, that psychological hurdle we mentioned with the Clippers and the Warriors. Like, the Clippers haven't beaten the Warriors, and I think that it's been, like, a couple of years now since they had their last victory over the Warriors.
Yeah.
And, you know, they had that game back in December where we got, you know, we were so excited. Like, Clippers-Warriors are going to be so fun, and then the Clippers get blown out by 20 points. So, yeah, I think there's definitely some merit to the idea that Cleveland does not fear the Warriors. They know they can beat the Warriors. They know no lead is safe against the Warriors. So I'm with you. I think, you know, I might be a slave to the moment right now, but I think I would choose Cleveland over Golden State if I had to pick right now. That said, you know, obviously injuries on both sides are going to go a long way toward determining, you know, I would not feel comfortable either way locking my pick in now for June, because if LeBron goes down, Cleveland's not even making the finals. If KD goes down, you know, it's going to be like 4-1 Cleveland, that kind of thing. So, yeah, I think it's fair to say that they are the commanding favorites to make it back to the finals, though, unless Toronto comes out with Paul Millsap and doesn't have to trade all that much in terms of, you know, current productive players. Maybe they just trade some fringe guys and some picks. But yeah, I mean, Toronto and Boston are really the only two teams I could even see giving them a challenge, but just seems unlikely at this point. So let's talk about Toronto, because, you know, we mentioned them earlier for the Millsap stuff. I'd say they've pretty firmly established themselves as the second best team in the East. Boston has been playing better of late, but still, Toronto is number two right now. They have the league's second best offense. They're only trailing the Warriors in that regard. Kyle Lowry and DeMar DeRozan are once again heading toward All-Star berths. And then they're getting a lot of... They don't have that third star, but they've got a bunch of complimentary contributions from Jonas Valanciunas, Damari Carroll, Patrick Patterson, Terrence Ross, Corey Joseph. So we talked about the Millsap thing. Even if that doesn't come to fruition, Mort, do you think they need to make some type of move like that to contend with Cleveland in a theoretical Eastern Conference Finals, or should they just feel comfortable rolling with their current lineup?
Well, let me just beforehand say that they have their third guy. They're just not utilizing him properly, and that's Valanciunas.
Mm.
I think he is once again being grotesquely underused.
Mm-hmm.
8.8 shots a game? Come on now. His offensive feel around the basket is so great. Like, you are just, you are going outside too much to DeRozan and to Lowry, and you're not creating a proper balance. I feel as though Toronto would be not significantly better, but at least a small level better if they utilized him more. I think the third guy's there. Having said that, I would still do the Millsap trade as I presented earlier, mm-hmm. because then you'd just have more weapons. And I think Millsap would kind of unlock Valanciunas a little bit because he's a great interior passer. Could you imagine Millsap on the on the low block? Valanciunas just makes a hard cut. Paul's going to find him right there. But Lowry and DeRozan, they are just too busy jacking up shots. And I jacking up shots, that sounds negative because it isn't, because it's going in, so it's fair. Right. But you're just ignoring a huge presence. He is so talented. And I am actually sitting here wondering, like, next year, if this trend continues, I could totally see Valanciunas demand a trade.
Mm. Yeah.
He is not getting the amount of shots or possibilities that he should be getting.
We mentioned him coming into the year as a guy, you know, he's never played more than 30 minutes a career, or 30 minutes per game during any season of his career, and we thought, hey, this is finally the year. You know, they lost Biombo. We didn't think any of the young guys were going to be ready to make a major impact. Still is under 30 minutes a game, and actually I'm glad you mentioned him, because ESPN Zach Lowe had a great column today that we'll talk about in a little bit, about this, the NBA's scoring explosion, and kind of how teams are going smaller and shooting a lot of threes, and if it's gone too far. In there is a quote from Raptors coach Dwayne Casey, and he's talking about JV. He says, "If your big guys don't dominate, you have to go small. I tell Jonas, oh, you want to play more? Then dominate. I don't want to see fadeaways over 6'8 guys. Get to the rim. Get every offensive rebound. If not, you're coming out." So it seems like...
That's fair.
Yeah.
I can get along with that.
So it seems like, I mean, Casey was one of the holdouts of this three-point trend. He's now kind of moved in that direction. He's, you know, he's playing Patrick Patterson a lot more. He's open to using Damari Carroll as a four as well. It seems like he wants I don't think he has like a vendetta against JV. I just think he's trying to push JV into a certain direction, and he doesn't necessarily do that all the time. So he's trying to get Valanciunas into that mindset of, every time I'm on the court, I need to bully the opposing player. I can't, you know, take a mid-range fadeaway. I need to like back my ass up in the post, get an easy layup, easy hook shot, easy dunk, that kind of thing.
Then who's failing? Is it Casey or is it Valanciunas? Because if Casey has argued that, you know, about this for a long time and tried making Valanciunas understand this, mm-hmm. like, at what point is his voice just getting too old? Or is it all on Valanciunas? Like, you have to ask that question. You have to raise it at least.
Right.
I agree. I have seen Valanciunas take ridiculous shots, but at the end of the day, he's a highly efficient offensive-minded center. Like, I would play it differently. I would have him out there, and I would just not give him the ball unless he's absolutely pissed off. I don't think sitting him is really doing a whole lot, especially because he's European. us Europeans are used to getting sit, Brian. we're used to not getting a whole lot of minutes. I mean, come on, just put his ass in there.
Yeah, it's a fair
point. And then just ignore him. And then just, you know, get Kyle going, get DeMar going until he's absolutely pissed. Mm-hmm. And then, oh, there you go. Go get it.
Yeah.
I will say, like, as a former frustrated big, I don't like the idea of people just saying, well, dominate. If you want the ball, dominate. No. Like, what the hell are you supposed to do when the guards have the ball the whole time? It's like, well, post up and demand the ball. I can't. How much can you demand the ball? If they don't want to give it to you, they're not giving it to you. You have to run the guy a few plays, throw him a bone, a few pick and rolls, get him involved. You can't get yourself involved as a big because you don't have the ball. You know, and this whole demand the ball thing is bullshit to me. So
yeah,
I will challenge that idea of, oh, just dominate. Okay, well, you know, you got to involve me a little bit.
Yeah, that's a good point. Like, to his two guards, you know, they're playing at all-star level, but they have two of the highest usage rates in the league, I imagine. So, yeah, they're wired in the sense of, like, all right, we're the top two options. Everyone else get in line behind us. It does seem like, you know, this is a fascinating subplot to watch for the rest of the season, is if they don't make this trade, can they get JV onto that level? Or is he just going to be, you know, can they make him into that third option, or is he just going to be a complimentary player like Ross, like Carroll, like Patterson? Because I think that'll go a long way. You know, Cleveland, we've said it for a while now, they don't have a true, like, rim-protecting center. Tristan Thompson is that guy, but they don't have, like, a true dominant. They don't have an Embiid, basically. So if JV can turn into
Valanciunas or Robin Lopez.
On both sides of the court?
I'm just saying, look, if they're not gonna use him, he's not like a defensive presence, and if that's what they want, then just ship him for Robin Lopez. If I'm not gonna be the one who underestimate his value, but if Toronto is, then fine, I'll make a call.
Yeah,
I'll ask. I mean,
as long as they include Rondo, right?
Yeah, please. Yeah. For the love of God, I could just find a local club in Siberia and take him.
I'll take him to Iceland in a couple weeks. Just leave him there.
Yeah. Like a local club there.
Yeah.
Still can't shoot in an open Icelandic gym.
Yeah, well.
Clank, clank. Oh, Rondo's practicing.
We'll definitely keep an eye on JV and see what happens with him. And if Toronto gets in on this Millsap bidding, if things heat up there. But I think it's definitely something to monitor moving forward. We're going to now quickly touch on a few things in our Where Amazing Happens segment and then do a few longer things as well. The first, we need to mention James Harden. I think this was on New Year's Eve, right? He has 53 points, 17 assists, and 16 rebounds. So everyone's out. Revelry. Come back, check your Twitter account. It's like, oh, James Harden had the first 50-15-15 game in NBA history. Okay, that's cool. It's pretty amazing. This is just my week.
Also better than Kobe's 81.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I've seen the set circulating. I don't know who had it, so I apologize in advance, but it was like the second.
Kelly Scaletta.
Was that Kelly?
Kelly Scaletta. Yeah, Kelly had the
second most points generated, either points or assists in NBA history, only behind Wilt's 100-point game. So it's just my week.
That's so ridiculous.
My weekly reminder that I had him as the preseason MVP, and you guys mocked me. So
I was thinking about you when he did it. I was like, oh, damn. I'm going to have to listen to Brian real soon. Yeah.
3 months away from one of the best victory laps in my life, but there's still a lot of time. I also want to shout out Popovich. He gave Craig Sager Jr. the tie that he wore to Craig Sager's funeral. Also, Pop flew to Atlanta to be at Sager's funeral the day the Spurs were playing in Houston. So just a reminder again that, you know, Pop comes off as this curmudgeon. You know, always gave Sager some trouble when he was on the sideline. But the guy, he's a good human being. So we just wanted to shout out Pop. Sarah, do you have any final dispatches from the Duncan retirement ceremony that you'd like to share, or just going to keep those warm in your heart?
I just, like Morton said, I thought everyone did a really great job. Yeah, Tony was really good. I was slightly surprised, but I don't know why, because he usually comes through. Manu. I think the one story that really stuck out the most to me was Tony talking about Tim staying like 20 minutes to play one-on-one with Boban, just defense, to help him get better. His 19th year in the league, you know, knee braces and everything, but he's working to try to help Boban get better. And for Manu, you know, taking him to dinner after a rough playoff game. So those are the things that you're not surprised at all to hear them. You kind of knew that kind of stuff went on, but it just confirms what you always thought about him. I'll also say the video that his brother produced, Timmy's brother, I think Scott Duncan, produced was really great. I mean, that was perfect. I haven't seen the whole thing up on YouTube yet. I think maybe they had some trouble getting the rights for the song that they had in it, but there is a version on YouTube if you haven't seen it. It's really well done. Tim gets to say his final goodbye. So.
Oh, okay. I have not seen it, so I will be checking that out after we finish up here.
Oh, you need to see it. Sarah, like, did the entire AT&T Center cry when Tim told Pop that he was like a father?
It was rough. It was rough in there. I know that I was leaking tears the entire time. Yeah. So I assume I wasn't the only one.
I was like up at 4 a.m. watching it.
Oh my God.
And when he said that, it was like the perfect touch to the end of this career, because we always, like everyone in the media, always said like, oh, they have this son-dad relationship, you know, unofficially. And then Tim fucking said it at the end. It was like, whew. Yeah. Not crying, I'm just chopping onions.
Yeah, it's a little dusty in here.
Yeah, at four in the morning. Yeah.
At the moment where Pop had, like in the arena, I couldn't tell it at first, and then I realized, oh, he's struggling to get through this. My God. Yeah. Anytime you see him moved like that, it's always really impactful.
So hard. And yeah. I want a statue of Tony and Pop's fist bump. Yes. I want a statue of it. Like a mechanical statue that moves, so it does it all the time. Like that fist bump needs, I have no understanding of why that fist bump has not become like a gif that we use on Twitter daily. That was epic.
Yeah,
epic.
You know what, I don't think it all was broadcast, but that whole thing was a really great moment, because Tony had just said, oh, you have to be really mentally tough to play for Pop, really mentally tough. And there actually was a moment in the arena where they cut to Pop, and Pop was making a face like, what's he talking about? You know, like he had no idea. And they cut to Tim, and Tim was like, I don't know. I don't know what he's talking about. He's crazy. And then that was what precipitated the moment where then Tony went over and did the fist bump. But it just was, you know, a reminder of what great chemistry those guys all had. And it just was such a perfect fit. And we were so lucky to have that big three and that coach for as long as we did.
Damn onions.
Damn onions. I liked all the jokes about his mom jeans, personally. That was a nice touch. So thank you, Sarah, for sharing your dispatch from there. I'm glad it lived up to expectations.
Definitely.
As I mentioned before, I want to talk briefly about the Zach Lowe column. He just published it today on the NBA scoring explosion. You should check it out if you have not yet, because it is fantastic, like everything Zach Lowe writes. So a couple interesting stats here before we go into the discussion of it. He says the NBA smashes the all-time record for three-point attempts every season. 31% of shots have come from deep this season, up from 28.5% last season and 24% in 2012-13. He says the league is on pace to break the all-time record in points per possession, due almost entirely to the three-point bonanza and its ripple effects. The league overall is pouring in about 105.5 points per 100 possessions, dead even with the three or four most prolific scoring seasons in NBA history. So, and he says offense tends to surge as the season goes on, so there's a chance this gets even more ridiculous, basically. So his question, or his column, was basically asking, you know, is this a problem? Is this, you know, is it fun to watch these like 123 to 116 games? Or does the league need to somehow intervene and change the rules so, you know, it's harder to score a little bit? He mentioned a few solutions: softening hand check restrictions, abolishing a defensive 3 seconds call, giving defenders more benefit of the doubt when you're 50-50 charge block calls, or using more zone defenses. So, Sarah, I want to turn this to you because Pop is infamously very, very anti-three-pointer. Do you think this three-point explosion is a problem that the league needs to intervene with, or are you fine with the way the game is stylistically played today?
I'm not sure about any of it. I kind of go back and forth. Overall, I don't think that anything so drastic as the league needing to intervene is called for. It does make you kind of understand Pop's argument as far as with such a trend towards just threes and layups or what, you know, it does kind of take away from other elements of the game of basketball that have been around forever. Except for in San Antonio, where Pop is, you know, we have the majority of our points come from the mid-range. Or no, not the majority, but we have the highest percentage of our points coming from mid-range. It's interesting. I still, every now and then, if I see threes taken on the fast break, you know, I still kind of cringe. Because even our generation, you know, if we grew up with any coaching at all, you know, you were never allowed to do that. And I still prefer the sure 2 points over the maybe three, unless it's a guy like Steph or, you know, maybe Patty Mills, Danny Green, fine. But I still like taking the points that you know you can get. So it's weird. But overall, I think it is fun to watch. Every now and then you get those games where teams are just firing up a bunch of threes and not making them, and that's kind of horrid. But I don't think the league is really getting that many complaints so far this year. People are excited about the way Houston's playing. Obviously, Golden State has its share of haters, but that's just because they're so darn good. I don't think that the league needs to change anything. What they can do is start calling fouls the way that they're technically supposed to be called, but it's kind of never happened that way.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's a league directive, so I don't want to tear down officials, but just as far as the offensive players, yeah, pay attention to whether they're creating the contact or not. I know that's a hard thing sometimes to tell, but, you know, as a defender, if you're just occupying your space, you're supposed to be allowed to do that. And if somebody comes into you and they create the contact, then that should either be an offensive foul or a no call. Mm-hmm. Just let them miss the shot then or make the tough shot, but it's not a defensive foul. So that they could change. I don't want to see more zone. I don't want to see them abolish defensive 3 seconds, I don't think. And I don't necessarily want to see more hand-checking, although imagining Kawhi being able to hand-check is pretty fun. But I don't want to see any of that happen.
Yeah, Zach Lowe did mention on that point about you saying like maybe just calling fouls more. His column, he does mention, it's hard to prove, but most coaches in front of front office executives agree defenses get away with a little more bump and grind than in the mid-2000s. And he says the league has heard those concerns and is monitoring that. So it sounds like it might be a league directive a little bit, that they're just not necessarily calling every single foul, because you don't want every player to foul out every game, basically. It seems like that might be kind of the easiest tweak if they need to make changes. But more, you know, your Bulls, your spacing devoid Bulls have not benefited from this three-point revolution. So how do you feel about this style of play? Do you like it? Do you think it should change?
Well, I'm not really going to argue against the effectivity. I don't even know what that's called. How effective the three-pointer is. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to argue against that because it's highly effective. Teams are going to use the shot that they're going to get, and that's the three-ball. Mm-hmm. However, stylistically, I mean, I grew up a Michael Jordan fan. I loved the way he could manufacture mid-range shots out of nothing. Like, defenses could be draped all over him, and he would somehow, some way, find a way to get a shot off in the mid-range area. Because that's that distance is more feasible to get a shot off from. You can't do that outside the three-point line. You have to be somewhat open, and you have to be straight on line. So you don't get the highly acrobatic layups that Mike used to do anymore. Those have kind of gone away because now you're looking at the standstill shooter in the corner, or you're looking for a wide open layup. Mm-hmm. And again, I get it. I get why it's happening, and I love the fact that the NBA has embraced it, and it's because now it's all about mathematics, and it's working. It's making a better product. Mm-hmm. Stylistically, though, yeah, I do miss the mid-range creational area, and I do miss, like, a Hakeem Olajuwon postman.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God. I mean, look, the post-up is one of those things that... It's so ineffective these days.
Right.
So ineffective. And I respect that. But good Lord, how I miss the post-up. Just how it looked and how one could dominate the block on any given night. That was gorgeous. I do think the power of balance has been switched a little bit over to the offensive player, as Sarah alluded mm-hmm. to. I think it's utterly ridiculous that Nikola Mirotic can do a pump fake from 35 feet, get a guy vertical, and then jump into him and get three free free throws.
Right,
that's
right.
Ridiculous. Yeah. I mean, there's no business in that. And it's so obvious that when it's called, even if I'm rooting for Mirotić, I'm sitting there going, ah, come on.
Yeah.
That's weak. I mean, because I don't want to see the game be turned into mockery. And when it's called that way, it becomes a mockery of the game. So do I want to see changes? Yeah, and I'm not entirely against handshaking either. I like handshaking. I like the fact that people could bump one another and put two hands on people and try to guide them a little bit. I mean, again, I grew up with Mike and Scotty. They were handshaking all the damn time. It was fun to see. Like, they could force turnovers at midcourt, which would get them out on the break. I love fast break basketball, and handshaking, I imagine, would create a lot of steals and would create a lot of fast break opportunities. And again, like Sarah alluded to, that would end in a slam dunk instead of a spot up three in transition, which is another play I also hate. I really do not like seeing a guy in front of everyone just pull up for a three instead of going in for the jam. Go for the dunk, goddammit.
Yeah. I mean, I think both of you brought up some valid points. You know, one of the big concerns mentioned in Lowe's column is he says post-up bigs who can't shoot threes or defend similar players. He mentions Greg Monroe, Jahlil Okafor, Al Jefferson, Enes Kanter, Nikola Vucevic have already been relegated to bench roles. They worry that, you know, if this trend continues, they might just get played out of the league entirely. So, you know, in that regard, I can understand why there is some concern because, yeah, I mean, it is, you know, those post-up bigs are, you know, a relic of how basketball used to be played. And it's going to be weird. You know, it still takes a second when you see, it's not even this new wave of, like, the unicorn, quote-unquote, the towns and Embiid and Porzingis and Miles Turner pulling up the three that they've had that skill set since they came into the league until a year or two ago. But seeing Lopez So there's definitely some, like, cognitive dissonance there. That said, I mean, I also don't think the league needs to intervene all that much, at least not yet. Maybe if this becomes a trend over 5 years and viewership goes down, et cetera, then they start addressing it. At this point, I think it's, you know, there's just not enough data to really make wholesale changes. And I don't necessarily know that there's any evidence it's less enjoyable. I think if you asked a casual fan, I bet they would rather see a game where both teams crack 100 versus like a defensive battle where it's 85 to 79 or something like that. You know,
right? Right.
Fans want to score. Fans want to see players score baskets. So I think in that regard, you know, I don't think the league needs to intervene. I might just be pro this style of play because my team has one of the unicorns that, you know, that they have in Embiid who can comfortably catch and shoot and fire away from 3-point range, even though he's 7'2". I feel like, you know, now that that is in vogue, we're going to see more big guys able to do that coming into the league. So I don't know, you know, we have some of these, the Okafor and Jefferson and Greg Monroe, but like if they can't adjust their games, is it really the league's fault? Like, should the league adjust because these guys can't add that to their tool set? Like, I think that's just something, you know, first of all, it's not Okafor's only problem. Like, learning to cover a pick and roll would be far more valuable. And then I also think like a team is going to figure out a way. The pendulum's going to swing at some point. A team is going to figure out a defensive scheme to hamper these 3-point heavy players. And, you know, like in the low column, Gordon Hayward tells him, "We've already reached the point where we're willing to give up some twos, even near the basket, to prevent corner threes." So maybe a team sticks their starting center out in the as a corner three, drawing out the opposing corner or the opposing center, and then a team has a free reign to the basket, you know? So I think there are going to be shifts. Coaches are going to figure this thing out, I think. So I don't think the league needs to intervene. I think you should let coaches have a shot at, you know, coming up with a strategy, basically like Tom Thibodeau did a couple years ago. In Boston and then Chicago, and the whole league copycatted, and then this whole style of play came in. So I think, you know, in every sport, this is always how it goes. Like, there's some newfangled offensive system. Everyone tries to copy it. Then someone comes up with a defensive way to stop it. Everyone copies that. Then a new offensive system comes out. So as you said, Mort, this is basic math. Three is more than two. At a certain point, you just have to weigh the efficiency of a certain shot before realizing, like, hey, I should be shooting a corner three rather than a post-up. I earn X number of points per possession on these shots, and they are more than the post-up. But I don't, you know, I think we can all agree that the league does not need to make radical wholesale changes just yet. We should wait to see how this plays out.
Right. But one thing, though. Here's the thing. When you talk about the skill set of, for example, Joel Embiid, I think it's great that a center can pop outside for a three-pointer. That's fine. The thing is that nowadays you're seeking out the three consistently, which is great, but at times you're giving up wide open, you know, 12-foot push shots or even a dunk because, oh, hey, no, I need to go outside and shoot the three. At some point, it just becomes too much. At some point, you have to look at the game and go, all right, three-pointers, while amazingly efficient, seem to be the only shot that we're going to look at, disregarding the entirety of the floor. That's not something I would want to see as a fan. I would want to see a balanced offensive game. I mean, look, I don't even watch the All-Star game anymore because they're just jacking up threes on the break. Yeah, look, the All-Star game is shit. I don't know that, But still, I mean, it's not entertaining to me to watch solely three-pointers. I mean, I want to see guys get challenged a little bit more. Again, I'm going back to Mike, and I know people will say, oh, you're old, and I am, and I'm sorry. But look, I love the fact that he would take on four defenders, twirl his body, and somehow manufacture a shot. Like, the level of creativity in the body movements, that was what attracted me to basketball in the first place. Here's a man who somehow got around 3 to 4 people in a spin move while in the air. Now it's about spot up jump shots. And so from my perspective, and that's just me, and I'm old and I'm mad and I'm angry and just I should grow a beard and walk with a cane. But I miss the creativity of where the league once was. And I do think that the skill set in players today remains, so the league could still have the possibility of being that creative. It's just not being utilized because, oh my God, the three-pointer.
Right. Well, you know, maybe they start going again. I think the pendulum is going to swing where teams are focusing so much on guarding three-pointers. You're going to start giving up these open twos, and even like you're going to have breakdowns where you give up open layups, and a guy like, you know, a guy like Kyrie Irving, I'm not going to say he's MJ, but he does have like, he's one of the more creative finishers in the league, I would argue. So there is that style still there. It's not as prevalent, but it's not like it's not as extinct as Jahlil Okafor is going to be in 2 years.
Right.
I mean, exactly. Even Steph, that's fine. Last night, I mean, you know, both him and Kyrie are known more for their bombing, but they're really crafty finishers. Just hold tightly to Kawhi, Morton. He really is right now the closest thing we have to that Kobe MJ mold of the fadeaway, the turnaround, mid-ranger. Yeah. It's beautiful. Yeah, and I am. Like you said, I'm excited about the prospect of having more well-rounded players. Like, I like that bigs aren't just told to go stand on the block now. But, you know, that said, as long as it manifests itself that way and not at the complete expense of, like you said, let's turn down a post-up or let's turn down an open 15-footer, you know, no, I love mid-range and post-ups as well, as you guys know, so I don't want to see that disappear. But I still subscribe to the theory that history is cyclical, so I still think maybe it'll kind of come back around, but maybe it won't. That's something to keep an eye on, you know. Threes will always be worth more than two, so maybe this is just the direction we're going.
I definitely think, you know, a big man shooting threes, that is going to be common, only progressively more common moving forward. Like, the genie's out of the bottle there. We're not going to go back to a time where, you know, we're going to prefer a Jahlil Okafor over a Joel Embiid. You want a more well.
Unless you're Chicago, of course, then you sign with Sean Rondo.
That's true. That's true. They might be like the last bastion of 1990s. They're just trying to make Chicago basketball great again, Morton.
Robin Lopez, Taj Gibson, and Rashawn Rondo in the starting lineup. Come on now.
Jeez. Yeah. Well, that was a good talk, guys. I'm glad we could hash that out. Let's now move into our final segment, our crushes of, I guess, of 3 weeks now. Because we've had a couple weeks off for the holidays. So, Sarah, hit us with your crush of the last couple weeks.
Danny freaking
Green.
There
we go.
Because he counts as unheralded because he pretty consistently just gets shot on. And Spurs fans are the biggest offenders, usually. But he's been having a really good year, so of course you haven't heard about him. Like, last year it was all, what is wrong with Danny Green? He can't, you know, he's not shooting, he's not making them. Somebody even complained to one of the Spurs beat writers this year, who apparently must not have been watching any of the games or something, because they're like, is he ever going to get it together? Well, he's currently shooting 46% from three on the year, which is a career high. And over the last five games, he's shooting 55% from three. And he's also still the king of transition defense. Not necessarily the chase down block like LeBron or Jonathan Simmons is coming, but he just gets back and gets position, and he's good at stripping. You know, he's always going to defend for you, and he's hitting the three at a career clip right now. So I need to show Danny some love.
I like that pick. As someone who owned him in fantasy basketball last year, I had the wrong side of the Danny Green experience, but I'm glad that he's gotten his career back on track a little bit. Mort, how about you? Who was your crush the last couple weeks?
My crush drained 75 three-pointers in December. The Chicago Bulls as a team drained 87. So he was just 12 shy.
Oh my God.
And that's nice. Eric Gordon. Yep. And he's my crush not just because of his three-point total, it's because he looks healthy. And he's turning into the player we all thought he could be. And I love seeing that. He's sort of as... I don't want to say redemption story entirely, but it's on the cusp of it. But yeah, a guy making just 12 threes less than an entire team over the course of a full month Yeah, I'll take that.
That's pretty sick. I don't know. I don't remember where I saw this, so apologies if I'm lifting it from somewhere. But someone tweeted out yesterday that four of the Rockets, it was Gordon, Harden, Ryan Anderson, and Trevor Ariza, had more three-pointers than any other team in the league, including Golden State.
Yes.
So, yeah, that's I think we're going to – if that trend holds up, we're going to see a lot of Houston in the awards ceremony at the end of the year. You know, D'Antoni, Eric Gordon for sixth man, Harden for MVP, that kind of thing. So, yeah, it's been awesome to see him healthy. And, you know, after a couple tough years in New Orleans, and you can only hope – that he stays healthy, but so far so good for the Eric Gordon experience. And Sarah, I'm really glad you mentioned Danny Green, because I'm going to do the, this isn't even like a poor man's Danny Green, this is like the 5 cent Danny Green, but gotta give a shout out to my boy Hollis Thompson, who the Sixers waived yesterday. He was the longest tenured Sixer from the process era, because technically he and Nerlens Noel both came to the team in 2013-14. But Nerlens missed his whole first season while he was recovering from that torn ACL that he had in Kentucky. I mean, Hollis does not do much outside of catch-and-shoot three-pointers. He's dating back to his Georgetown days. He struggled when any time he was asked to create offense off the dribble. But he's a 38.9% career three-point shooter. I think on the right team, he could have some value in that role and then maybe develop into a 3-and-D guy, like a 12th man 3-and-D guy. So I'm hoping that Hollis can latch on somewhere, gets claimed off waivers. He's on the Hinkie special contract, so it would cost basically nothing to take him. You know, Cleveland, if they are down so many warm bodies, might be a good fit for him there. But I do hope someone can take Hollis and save him from having to go overseas, because I think he showed... frankly, coming out of Georgetown, I was not convinced he was an NBA player, and he proved me wrong during the last couple years of his time in Philly. So, like to shout out one last time, Hollis Thompson, the original gangster of the process. And that's going to do it for us for this week of the NBA podcast. Thanks again to everyone for listening. Again, be sure to check us out on Twitter at the NBA Pod. Find all three of our Twitter handles in there as well. Check us out on iTunes and download, subscribe, leave some reviews, and FanRag NBA and FanRag Sports on Twitter, who are being hosted this year, so check them out as well. Until next time, guys, I'm Brian Toporek, and I was joined by Morten Jensen and Sarah Chalea. As always, it was great talking to you two.
Likewise, Brian.
You too. Hey, can I just say one thing before we go? I'm mostly happy with the way that the All-Star returns look, the Zaza craziness aside. I'm a little disappointed in where Marc Gasol is.
Where is he?
He's like 10th in the front court.
What?
He's below Blake Griffin.
What?
I would have liked to see him as the starter, but you can't argue because AD puts up obscene numbers. But Memphis, it's time to mobilize. Go on, let's get going. Marc needs more votes.
Yes, hashtag... NBA vote, Marc Gasol, hashtag NBA vote, Joel Embiid. Let's get Marc Gasol starting, and let's get JoJo a date with Rihanna. All right, until next time, everyone, have a good one.